TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Dublin Interview with Professor Kevin Anderson. Kevin Anderson is Professor of Energy and Climate Change in the School of Mechanical Aerospace and Civil Engineering at the University of Manchester. He's also Deputy Director of the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research and active in academia with recent publications in Royal Society journals and in Nature. Before having this extraordinary academic career, Kevin Anderson was a mechanical engineer and worked on oil rigs and gas platforms. His dual background in engineering and academia make him a sought-after consultant. Anderson reported on aviation-related emissions to the European Union Parliament, advised the Prime Minister's Office on carbon trading, and has contributed to the development of the UK's Climate Change Act. Sadly, the governing bodies do not always act on his advice, and Anderson has become concerned that these institutions will not be able to act quickly enough to avert a climate catastrophe. With his colleague Alice Bowes, Kevin's work on carbon budgets has been pivotal in revealing the widening gulf between political rhetoric on climate change and the reality of rapidly escalating emissions. Today, the most often quoted tools to bring down carbon emissions are carbon trading, carbon taxes, and NASA's James Hansen's worldwide carbon fee, charged at a domestic mine or port of entry. DEFRA is the UK government's Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs. They are responsible for environmental protection. Kevin Anderson proposed a different system of rationing that was considered by DEFRA as ahead of its time when they looked at it in 2008. Although some argued that it was based on a successful system of rationing widely used in Europe and the US during World War II. In this conclusion of the interview of Kevin Anderson by John Gibbons, in Dublin, Ireland, in March 2016, Gibbons begins by asking how such a system of rationing would work.
Kevin, in terms of how we manage the descent, whether it's the energy descent or the demand descent, would you have a view as to how we can do this in a way that is fair, equitable and achievable? Are we talking then about carbon rationing on a per person basis?
I think that's one to seriously consider. I and some colleagues did some work on this quite a few years ago. David Miliband was the minister at DEFRA, and he was in fact the architect in the UK for the Climate Change Act in 2008. And he liked the idea of the personal carbon allowance that myself and some colleagues were working on, liked it sufficiently well that he had passed it on to the economists in DEFRA to analyse, and they came back and their broad conclusion was that it was a policy ahead of its time. Well, okay, that was 2008, we're now in 2016, perhaps we should be revisiting the idea of some sort of personal carbon allowance. One of the benefits of that sort of approach, if you're trying to bring very rapid reductions in our emissions that are necessary for our 2 degree C framing, is that it helps with the equity issues. It means the poorer people in our society would have, at least initially, would have plenty of carbon allowance to allow them to carry on their lives as they are. But better still, it means those people like myself, who would probably end up using more energy than my carbon allowance would permit, I would have to buy carbon effectively from them on the carbon market, which means I would be providing them with additional income. They would then spend some of that income on improving the amount of heating in their homes. That means their carbon emissions go up a little bit. But within the set carbon allowance, that means mine have to come down. And that means the wealthy people, unlike with a carbon tax, they have to drive the innovation process. And we know that the early adopters in society are the wealthy, the early adopters of new technology. It's the wealthy in our society that initially drive innovation. The great thing about a carbon allowance would drive that innovation process and protect people who are in positions of poverty and suffering already with high fuel prices. So I think there are some very strong merits to a personal carbon allowance. So we think if you're serious about large reductions in emissions, myself and a few colleagues felt this was a very serious instrument to consider and had lots of merits over and above a carbon tax. Now again, I think you have to go from country to country. Would it be appropriate in some countries and perhaps not in others? And there are certain issues you'd have to consider. But whatever instruments we talk about now for climate change, we are talking about very rapid reductions in carbon dioxide emissions.
If we think back to the last use of ration cards, obviously during the Second World War in Britain, a side effect of that was an increase in social solidarity in a time of crisis. You'd probably agree with me that we are in a time of crisis now and that we need an increase in social solidarity, an increase in the sense that we're in it together. I think there is a concern among many people that if you take an action, whether it's in your own case giving up flying or some other action, that all you're doing is making more space for the free riders.
Yes, yeah. That's completely true, of course. I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, you know, if I don't fly, then someone else can no doubt do that. Though I think the dynamic market signal is still important in that argument. Yeah, one thing I think is really important about when we think about some sort of personal carbon approach is that everyone is engaged. It's not saying that the elite can be exempt from this, that all the high emitters have to be involved. It has the same sort of sense of solidarity that we did get with rationing previously. Now, one thing to think about, this word rationing puts a lot of people off, but whatever method we use, whether it's a carbon tax, whether it's a regulation, or whether it's a personal carbon allowance, we have to ration out the scarce resource of how much carbon-based energy we can consume and how much carbon we can put in the atmosphere. That is a scarce resource. So whatever we do, rationing is inevitable. The thing about a carbon allowance card, it brings rationing directly to the fore. It's very clear. It keeps all of us involved. There's a level of fairness and there's a level of clarity to it that I think all of that helps engender wider acceptance and agreements within society than mechanisms whereby we very well know that some of the wealthy people will simply be able to pay that cost and not have to worry about the impacts. And so I think seeing us all in this together, you know, and there's something about that, all in this together, is something that would help engender a wider civil movement towards making significant reductions in our emissions.
And curiously, the whole notion of all in this together, it almost suggests that, if you like, a rowing back from the neoliberal there is no society model, because that's been the dominant economic and social model probably for the last 30 years. And it doesn't appear to have delivered increases in happiness. It certainly delivered increase in consumption, but it doesn't appear to have delivered increases in happiness. It hasn't delivered increases in social solidarity or social well-being that by most measures. So maybe there is something to be said for it.
Well, certainly. I mean, I think certainly what we've seen with the neoliberal model, it has increased absolute levels of consumption well-being.
Yeah.
But the question then for society, I suppose, is firstly, where has that gone? To whom has it gone? And has it increased the sense of well-being of society? And I think there are serious questions to be had about that. And of course, that's not related just to climate change, and not by any means. We've got the Pope coming out and talking about these things. We've got Stiglitz, you know, and Piketty, two very eminent economists coming out and talking about these things. So we see many world's leading thinkers coming out and actually saying the neoliberal model has had its time, and perhaps it should never have been there in the sort of pervasive level that it was. And that's regardless of climate change. I actually think that once you layer climate change on top of a lot of the social problems that have gone alongside this particular model, then I think there's a very clear state to move away from it as rapidly as possible. But in itself, of course, it has failed. I mean, people were better off materially up to 2008, and then if you look at Ireland and look at the UK, generally many of us now are only at that level, if not slightly below that level. So we've not seen, the wealthy have seen very significant increases and ongoing increases in their welfare, the material well-being. Yeah, the average person and the poor person certainly has not seen those increases.
And also this time, perhaps for the first time, the middle class has also been abandoned.
I think that's true, and it's not just the middle classes in terms of the if you like, the parents today. It's those parents looking at the prospects for their children, and that's, I think to some extent, that's even a bigger issue. You know, there are parents now looking at their children and think, my children will, I will be better off than my children will be. And in our modern sort of contemporary society, in post-industrial society, we have generally expected our children to be better off than we will. And this is probably the first generation within that society that is anticipating that their children may well not be better as well off as we are. And again, if we layer climate change on top of that, I think it's very unlikely that their children will be anywhere near as well off as people like I and you have been.
And that's, we've talked about rationing, we've talked about the neoliberal system. To take a step back, We also have, if you like, a global climate fund now, which is supposed to be contributing or redistributing, if you like, between at a governmental level, approximately $100 billion a year to help countries mitigate against and prepare for climate change. I gather you're not a fan.
Well, I'm not a fan of two things. First, I don't like, I mean, the language you use there, which is the language that's commonly used about redistribution. I say this is reparation. We have imposed on other parts of the world huge levels, both of damage and of no access to the sorts of things that we have had, i.e. fossil fuels and energy, to overcome those problems and also to see the improved welfare in their society. So we owe them reparation. It is not aid, it is not redistribution, it is what we owe them because of the damage that we have imposed upon their societies and how can we've constrained their ways of resolving the problems that they are facing. So firstly, it's reparation. Second is, what is the sum of money? It is a crumb that's fallen off the table. $100 billion per annum. The subsidy, that's to all the poor parts of the world, both to adapt to climate change that we've imposed upon their societies and to help them reduce their emissions or not follow the same high carbon energy route and agricultural route that we have chosen to go down in the West. $100 billion per annum. The subsidy to fossil fuels in 2015, according to the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, which is, you know, not a left-wing think tank or an NGO, I mean, it's a very reputable, generally fairly conservative organisation. Their estimate is that the subsidy to fossil fuels in 2015, the direct and the indirect subsidies, that does include and the health impacts of things like particulates in the atmosphere and how that affects, you know, health and bronchial issues, that the subsidy was $5.3 trillion. So forget the subsidies to renewables, forget the subsidies to nuclear. These are irrelevant relative to the subsidies that the globe has provided to the fossil fuel companies. 5.3 trillion.
So it's 50-fold.
53 times more than we're going to hand the poor parts of the world. Even the UK economy is 30 times more in a single year than the money we're going to give to the poorer parts of the world. And the real sad indictment to some extent to me of this is that not only is it a paltry sum, but then the sort of the clever bit is that we get ourselves to internally argue about, should it be 110, should it be 90, who should pay it? Mm. You know, we're arguing about the size of the crumb. It's not billions, it's trillions that we owe through reparation the poorer parts of the world. And we can see this, it's not even necessarily altruism, we can see it as self-interest. Mm. That if these parts of the world cannot deal with the climate change that we have imposed upon them, and you know, let's be very clear that we are at an outside chance of a 2°C rise, and that will have devastating consequences for many of the poorer parts of the world, but where lots of people live, and in the globalised world we are not insulated from those people anymore, from the impacts of increased food costs, from migration, from military tension. All of those things will play out at home in the UK, in Dublin, across all of Ireland. In a globalised world, we are not going to be able to just think we can close our doors and put up the barriers and think we're protected from climate change.
Yeah, the Syrian conflict, some have described as one of the first climate change wars, if you like. And of course, we've seen a huge migration crisis affecting Europe in ways that we simply never predicted.
Yes. Well, the first thing I would probably say is that I would be very cautious about saying it was triggered by climate change. But I do think it is fair to say there's some significant evidence, both in terms of Syria, but also previously in terms of Darfur, where we saw some, you know, terrible things happening there, that climate change was an exacerbating issue that, you know, was one of the catalysts that drove the sorts of changes that we've seen, you know, the disruption of that society in Syria. I think it would be unreasonable to say climate change was the thing that caused it, but that is the problem with climate change. It's always going to be layered on top of communities that are already stressed anyway. But what we've seen there, again, is indicative of what we'll see elsewhere, when climate change will stress already stressed communities, and we'll see this sort of fragmentation and breakdown of society. And it's a relatively small country, Syria. And I think, just looking at Bangladesh, there are 30 million people who live within 1 meter of sea level rise on the coastal strip of Bangladesh, 30 million. That's half the size of the UK, and your population here in Ireland is, what, 4.5 million? Mm. So, you know, 30 million people. Now, they are going to be hit by climate change, both by sea level rise, and they already are, of course, been hit by sea level rise, by increased severity of storms and typhoons, and likely by increased frequency of these events as well. That can affect their agricultural systems, it can affect their home, their infrastructure. They are going to be on the move, en masse.
Right. The US military, who, again, not a renowned left-wing organization, they have an interesting phrase they use to describe climate change. They describe it as a threat multiplier. And they see it as being something that exacerbates existing conflicts, existing tensions, existing resource crises. For example, what happened in Cumbria over the last few months, what happened in the Shannon region in Ireland, having a debate about was this one climate change, was it not? In a climate changed world, maybe what we really need to say is clearly the dice are being loaded. Would you accept that?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. What we are seeing is a new normal.
Yes.
Any single event could be an extreme weather event. What we see when we see lots of extreme weather events, what we have is a new normal, and that's when we can see the climate signal. The frequency of these events occurring means that we are seeing climate change. Now, there's some evidence to suggest that we're definitely seeing that now, and from the physics, from the basic science and the physics that we understand very well, and also from the modelling that goes alongside that, we expect to see, almost certainly, we're going to see ongoing increases in severity and frequency of these sorts of extreme weather events that are already percolating around the world. But in addition to that, of course, they are, as you say before, they are threat multipliers. Now, for the poorer parts of the world that are, well, the more vulnerable parts of the world that are already stressed anyway, people are struggling to eke out a living or in these communities, this threat multiplier could very quickly catalyze significant, you know, disruption, dislocation, migration, military tensions and so forth. But as you pointed out, we've already seen that in some of our own communities at home. If you like, we live quite comfortable lives, and then we are suddenly hit by this thing that has a very... The frequency of these things is having a very clear climate signal. We are going to be seeing these things more regularly. And so therefore, it's not as if it's just a threat multiplier on top of the other things that we face. We live comfortable lives, and then suddenly we're hit by this thing, which is extreme weather. And that extreme weather is causing us huge problems. So even societies that are fairly resilient and robust are really struggling with what we really, when you think about it, we've only seen a 1 degree C temperature rise so far. And this is going to go on and on and on. In the warmest year on record, 2015, if we look since 2000, we have seen year after year after year of the warmest year on record. The carbon dioxide emissions now are higher than they have been for 800,000 years, three times longer than humans are on the planet. The carbon dioxide emissions this year will be 60% higher than they were in 1990. Every single measure that we use shows that we are moving towards a new planet, a different place to live. Unless we make radical changes to our emissions, then we are going to be, you know, passing on to our children, to the poor parts of the world, but even to those of us that will be here in 10 or 20 or 30 years, a radically different planet to live on.
We focused, understandably, Kevin, so far on one species. There's a few million other species as well. I thought we should give them a moment or two. According to the World Wildlife Fund, the total number of wild animals in the world has declined by just over 50% in the last 40 years. Now that suggests that what's been described as the sixth extinction event is already in full flow. Mm. And I wonder, first of all, if you have any thoughts regarding that, considering these are our fellow creatures, both from the point of view of their right to exist in the world with alongside humans, but also as, if you like, as a cautionary tale for what goes around comes around.
Mm. Well, I think, going with the second of those first, the cautionary tale, I think that we, as an academic who doesn't work on this particular area in detail, but I nevertheless think what we can see from this and talking with other colleagues is that this is indicative of the scale of change that we are seeing. And when I say that, it's the rate of change that's important. If these changes occurred across, you know, 20 million years, 20,000 years, fine. These changes occurring, you know, within the blink of an eye, I mean, within a handful of generations, we're seeing dramatic changes. You know, arguably, within a generation, we're seeing significant changes. So I think that what we're seeing globally here, within the sort of, let's call it the natural world, but I mean, really, that's partly the problem, but we have removed ourselves from the natural world when we are really part of it and completely reliant upon it. You know, without the natural world, we do not exist. So we are seeing these significant changes. All of the people that analyse this have significant concerns. I've not heard anyone that does not think that what we're seeing is very significant, and actually this raises really fundamental concerns for how we as a species are going to survive. Mm. I think seeing ourselves as separate has been part of the problem here. So from a science perspective, I think what we are seeing is as clear a warning as you should ever need, that we need to do something very differently and very rapidly. But the other part, going back to saying about their right to exist and so forth, I mean, this is a deeply sort of a felt feeling for me as to why I partly engage in climate change. I mean, it has nothing to do with the science per se, that there's a beauty to our planet, in the way I see this. There's a beauty to our planet, not as a static sort of Victorian view of it that we can pin it out like butterfly wings on a plate and keep it in the museum or whatever it may be, but the dynamics, the beauty of the evolution of our planet. And what we have done, what we have done consciously and knowingly, is we have come in, as I said before, like the meteorite, and we are destroying that process overnight. And we think it's perfectly reasonable to do that, or at least it's not reasonable to not do it. We're not prepared to make the changes to avoid doing that when we have all of the information at our fingertips. So to destroy this place of absolute beauty that we don't know of anywhere else in the universe that is like this. And anyway, even if it did exist, there's still something, you know, much more entwined in being part of this beautiful system, which we are part of it, and we are a wonderful part of it. You know, that we exist as a species is, in a sense, is a splendid outcome of the 3 billion years of evolution that we've had on the planet. And that we have that arrogance now, when we can see all this around us, to think we can destroy not just ourselves, but take the rest of it with us. Mm. I don't mean this in any sort of any religious perspective at all, but from a, and perhaps spiritual isn't even necessarily the right word, but there's something in that dynamic beauty of our planet that makes me very concerned about issues of climate change, over and above the effects it will have on me, my communities, different parts of the world and so forth. Over and above that, there's this deeper entrenched love, respect for, you know, for the place that we live, the place that we have evolved, the place that has nurtured us as a species.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds, what you're describing sounds a lot like a moral framing of it, and also perhaps a moral reckoning.
Yes, I think that's a way to see it. But I mean, I almost think though we often use the word amoral or perhaps sometimes immoral, that all of the framings we have some framing of morality in it, but we may question people's different moral frameworks. Mm. But yes, without a doubt, I think we have to be careful here. There isn't a completely neutral approach to anything. Whatever framework we have has some moral dimension to it. So other people might turn around and say it's ridiculous to be talking about this sort of moral framework for these issues. But actually, by saying that, you already have a moral framework and an ethical framework. Mm. You know, humans have moral and ethical frameworks, and that informs everything we do. It informs how we do our science and our physics. Mm. It informs, you know, every facet of our society. So we will never be, and can never be, and in fact it's a very good thing we can never be like this. We can never be some sort of purely objective, atomized individual. That's not how living species, certainly the human species, has evolved.
To conclude, Kevin, what kind of a world do you see by the middle of this century, knowing what you know about, number one, the science, and number two, human nature and how we do our politics?
No, hmm. I think here it is there's a probability answer here. You know, the chances are that we're going to carry on choosing to fail, and I'm careful about my language there. We are choosing to fail, and we will likely carry on choosing to fail. We will make the right noises, and sometimes we will make the right noises for the right reasons, but with the wrong reasoning. And I say that word reasoning here because the issue about all of this is time. And actually, the scientists have not been particularly helpful here, in that we have allowed this language of a certain emission reduction by 2050, or by 2030, by some period, you know, not in my term of office, from a politician's point of view, or we're passing the problem onto the future generations to solve, we hope, with the technology. But actually, climate change isn't about that. It's about this build-up of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere day in, day out. It is a timing issue. So we are choosing to fail. We are choosing to not take notice of our science. And even those of us who work on science are not being vociferous enough about the misuse of our science by policymakers and by wider civil society. So we're all in this sort of collective delusion together, and I include the scientists in this. So if we carry on along those lines, and at the moment, if you're a betting person, which I'm not, I think you'd say that's very likely that we will carry on with sort of, you know, rhetoric, the odd tap on the back after a successful COP and a paper agreement that doesn't bring about any action, and we'll carry on like this, and the temperature will keep changing, the world will keep changing. Initially it'll hit poor people, typically non-white, low emitters in the southern hemisphere, then gradually that will affect food prices, it will affect, you know, wars, it will affect access to resources, and then eventually, far too late, we'll come along and think, well, actually we should have done something about this, what can we do now? And our first response, as we're seeing with the migration issues, is that we'll put up the borders, we'll protect our own well-being, we'll think we're somehow more important than the rest of Europe, or the rest of our colleagues and partners around us, so we will break up and fragment any sense of union which we require, essentially require to address these issues. So that's, for those who have seen the film The Road, that's the road that we are on, and not one that I want to hand to my nieces and my nephews, not one I want to hand to the poor parts of the world, and not one that is in any way appropriate for the beauty of our planet that I was talking about earlier. But it's a probability issue. Yeah, and there was a word of agency in there. We are likely to choose to fail, but we have an opportunity to choose to succeed. And the reason that people like myself, and I'm sure many of us, work on climate change, I mean, not some people just love working on climate change, it's interesting work in universities, running models, playing with the maths, looking at the science, but others of us are in there because we like all of that, but we also think it's a worthwhile subject area. Mm. And those of us that think of it like that, we are working this area because we want to instigate change along the lines of what society has told us it wants to deliver, i.e. avoid dangerous climate change, a safe climate within which we can all thrive and prosper, both with our species and other species as well. We are choosing to fail at the moment. We could choose to succeed. We know what we need to do. We have all the wherewithal intellectually, financially, in relation to resources, in terms of renewable energy. We have plenty of that around. We have the intellect and the labour skills to put this stuff in place. We can reduce our energy demand very rapidly without significantly changing the quality of our life, at least for the majority of us. And we can help the poor around the world. We know how to help the poor around the world. We can learn lessons from all around the world in a globalised world. We can see how other people have done things and where they've been successful and where they haven't been successful. We have everything at our fingertips to deliver a low carbon, a zero carbon from an energy perspective, and a very low carbon agricultural system that is in line with a prosperous, thriving society that has its appropriate role as part of this beautiful, dynamic, evolving planet on which we live. All of that is up for grabs. Just at the moment, we are running scared of changing the direction that we're heading, which is the complete polar opposite of that.
This is the urgent conclusion of a one-hour interview with Kevin Anderson, Professor of Energy and Climate Change at the University of Manchester and Deputy Director of the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research. Thanks to the National Trust for Ireland and John Gibbons for posting this moving conversation on YouTube. It is the source of the program that you just heard. The conversation took place in Dublin in March 2016. The link to the film is on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.